Well, another great show, Paula. I appreciate that. They always make me want to go there the first time and the last performance to see the difference between the first one and the last one. And that one seems pretty complex. We wish them good luck at the Northfield Arts Guild Theater. Well, it's a Friday morning. It's sunny, then it isn't, then it is, then it isn't, then it is. What's it going to do today on the 13th day of July? It is the year 2018, and my guest today is the same fellow I've had a couple of times before, and this is part three, so we can finish the story. And I just love listening to your stories. Brian Bornick, welcome back to the Wayne Eddy Affair.
Thanks, Wayne. Good to be here.
Now, I just heard you chit-chatting with Andy about the weather. What's the story on that?
I'm not one for humidity, so I don't mind heat. Obviously, I spend a lot of time in the desert, wearing a lot of battle gear. So the heat doesn't bother me, but the humidity just drains me. So hopefully one day when my kids are a little bit more on their own and I can be a little freer for where I want to live, I think a trip to the south is probably in our future. My wife and I both love Texas and Arizona, so we're interested in, over the next maybe couple of years, finding a place we might want to settle down there for the rest of our lives.
Well, it seems to me that I've been to Houston. I didn't find that very pleasant.
Yeah, no, we're very selective. So the area of Texas we really prefer is between San Antonio and Austin, kind of along the foothills there.
Okay. And, of course, you're referring to the fact that you spent some time during Desert Storm?
Operation Iraqi Freedom.
Operation Iraqi. How many different names does that war have?
Well, there's quite a few. So we migrated. There's my time really in the military was Operation Iraqi Freedom, specialized in Iraq. Operation Enduring Freedom, focused on Afghanistan, and then of course it transitioned as we were kind of reducing troop counts into Operation New Dawn. So that's my familiarity with it.
Okay, and of course I'm confused. By the way, did I say that Brian Bornick is my guest?
You did.
Oh, okay. Just got to make sure, because people say, well, who is that guy? I want to figure this out all by myself.
Even after you tell them, they'll probably still say that.
Well, no, as a matter of fact, I ran into a guy Wednesday night, a friend of mine and his wife, and we were chit-chatting about the Wayne Eddy Affair that you were on, and he said, I never knew that in regards to no beards in the Army.
Oh, yeah.
Because it affects the flow of
the seal of the gas mask.
The seal of the gas mask when they have, they use terrible things like Saddam Hussein. And by the way, that's where we ended up.
We did.
We talked about Saddam Hussein, except that you were talking about his kids. Now, folks, what we have here is a gentleman that lives here in Northfield, along with his wife, Michelle. And, of course, they have Henry, age 5, and also a 3-year-old girl, Reagan, and then twins, Zeke and Rennie, at 1 year old. And, of course, Brian is the father of 24-year-old Kylie, 22-year-old Kendra, and 17-year-old Logan, and the brother of a little sister named Mitzi. Did I get that all right?
You got it right.
All right. Now, we have talked about your career, where you grew up, what position you played on sports teams and all that.
Mm-hmm.
And then we got to the war. And some millennials, that's their life. That's all they've known is war.
My son, Logan, was born January 2001. So basically, since he's been 9 months old, this war has been part of his life.
Yeah, and I was born at the beginning of the Second World War. And then I was alive and only aware about the Korean War, which I, for some reason, know that there was a shortage of metal or something, and they didn't have chrome bumpers on cars because of some process that took up metal. And then, of course, I was drafted for the Vietnam War, and fortunately, I was rejected by the Army. And then, of course, these wars, and I say these, we're talking Afghanistan, Iraq, Iran, and the Carter administration, 444 days of captivity and all that. So it's sure. been a stressful thing for people.
Yeah, your and there's age. There's even a lot of things. Those are the ones that people relatively know a little bit more than average about. But, you know, I mean, think about it. There was Bosnia, there was Herzegovina, there was
Granada,
Serbia, there was Granada, there was Panama, there was the Falkland Islands. There's just been, I mean, there's been a lot of conflict in the war, really, in our lives. It's just that when you send tens of thousands, hundreds of thousands of soldiers across the ocean, halfway around the world, you know, pretty consistently over the course of, you know, 9, 12, 15 months on a constant rotation, people tend to get a little more familiar with it.
Yeah, I guess so. Now, your wife, Michelle, is also retired from the Army.
She is. She is. And I appreciate you having me on my show, but if you're going to ask me, Michelle's the real hero in the house. So.
Well, there's always another day. Now, one of the things that I found interesting was the sons of Saddam Hussein. Mm-hmm. And I want to get into that in a minute, but first I have to do this, and that is talk about the QB, the quarterback club here in Northfield. As a matter of fact, I go there all the time, and I enjoy great breakfasts, and their breakfast service is over right now, 6 to 10 each morning, Monday through Saturday. And they are open Sunday, but they open late to allow places to have their pancake feeds and things like that. Now, today is Friday, and you have a wonderful opportunity if you're one of those people that like to have fish on Friday, either because you were raised that way or because you just have gotten used to it. Well, they have a wonderful fish sandwich, a wonderful fish, deep-fried fish. Oh, it's so good. It's cod. It's really good. The Quarterback Club, locally owned and locally managed right here in Northfield on Highway 3 and 3rd Street. Stop in this afternoon for lunch.
Affordable living could be yours at Northfield Manor. Located on the campus of the Northfield Retirement Community, the Manor offers HUD-supported one-bedroom apartments for seniors age 62 and older, or for persons with a disability. If your annual income is less than $43,750 per year, you could qualify. Northfield Manor tenants enjoy all the amenities that the Northfield Retirement Community campus has to offer. For more information, call 507-650-7332 today. Northfield Retirement Community. Innovation, choice, tradition.
We're back on the Wayne Eddy Affair on KYMN Radio. It is 10:10. That is the time, and right at the very moment, it is a little bit overcast. And you were mentioning humidity, and I like warm. Mm-hmm. And I'll have to tell you, yesterday, I just was lazy, totally lazy. I'd go outside, walking into a sauna.
Yeah.
And then I'd come in and I'd read a book and I'd think about all the things I should be getting done. And here I am just loafing around, reading a book, watch a TV show, go out on the deck and say,
yeah. So we'll talk more about it, I'm sure, as we progress. But working at the VA, yesterday was one of those days where I actually appreciated that my office is in the basement of the VA.
Oh, yeah.
Because, you know, I get there 8 o'clock in the morning. I don't leave till 5:30, 6 o'clock at night. And guess what? I had no idea how humid it was outside. But then when you walk out after work and that hits you, it's like a furnace blast.
How do you do your commute there, by the way? What's your route?
Well, obviously in the Twin Cities, the traffic patterns always kind of shift things. But there's two primary ways that I actually get from here up to the VA. It's either up 3 and then cut off on 149 to get to 55, or I take 52 up to 55 and then bring that in.
Okay. All right, never the freeway.
No, usually I try to avoid that. Yeah. The freeway on a good day will add probably 20 minutes to that commute at least. So.
And then you would take the crosstown.
Well, so the VA hospital is actually right where 55 and the crosstown meet, so I never have to get on the crosstown.
Oh, that's good.
Mm-hmm.
And how far do you have to walk after you park?
Depends on how early I get there. You know, it's probably about a 5-minute on average walk from where I park to the building.
Even in the wintertime, huh?
Oh, yeah.
And how old is the building you're in?
I support all of the customers of the VA, and so in the Minneapolis area. And they have multiple buildings.
Paul.
Yeah, St. Paul. So Minneapolis and St. Paul. So we have the Burger Federal building in St. Paul. We have tenants or customers that sit and
work there.
Is that
on Kellogg?
It is, yes.
In Minnesota?
Oh.
Okay.
And then, of course, the Minneapolis Federal Building, we have some folks there. Then there's the hospital, the main facility, treatment facility here. And then there's the Whipple Federal Building on Fort Snelling. And then I also take care of the National Cemetery on Fort Snelling. And there's workers, employees that are there. So I kind of bounce around. I have several offices in each of these buildings. But for the most part, you know, the hospital, I think, was built in the early 80s and has been under significant renovation over the last probably 10 years. Recently, if you haven't been up there lately, I would encourage people. They built a really nice kind of heated connection walkway that goes from the parking ramp into the outpatient and the main entrances. And along there, they have kind of tributes to all of the branches of the armed service in etched glass. It's really, really classy. So I encourage you to take a look. It's nice.
What do you do about smokers? Because I know that a lot of young men and women take up smoking in Vietnam, or certainly the Second World War. They're
sure.
Dying off every day, unfortunately. But do you have set-aside places for these people that are getting a little bit older and they still like their smoking?
There are designated areas in the hospital so that it doesn't impact those that choose not to.
Okay.
But we certainly want to respect the rights and wishes of the people who do. So they affectionately referred to smoke shacks throughout the outer perimeter of the building.
Okay. And of course, other hospitals don't have that I'm aware of. Well, that's being considerate of those individuals, and it might be a calming effect when they learn negative news.
Yeah, it does have that, and I will tell you, both the veterans and the families that come there. I mean, there's frequently quite a few people that are visiting those little designated areas. So,
I remember an airport I was in, and I can't recall which one it was, but every 100 yards, they had a little smoking place, and you'd walk in there and you'd go, God, that stinks.
Mm. Yeah, but looking at it from the outside in, it kind of reminded you of Amsterdam, I think. So.
Yeah, well, okay. It's 10:14, and my gentleman friend here is a retired lieutenant colonel, now working for the Veterans Administration and all kinds of other jobs. In addition to that, you mentioned you had another responsibility that I wanted to ask you a question about.
Mm-hmm.
What are they again that you do in the VA?
Oh, the customers? So the cemetery, the National Cemetery.
Cemetery, that's right, yeah. You're in charge of that whole thing?
Well, I'm in charge of supporting the information technology needs of that cemetery. So they have their own, you know, director and their own staff administration that actually, you know, help veterans transition through a very emotional time. I mean, if you look at the Minneapolis area, not all VAs, not all geographic areas are like this, but because we've extended prenatal and, you know, birth care to our veterans now with congressional mandates over the last couple of years, the Minneapolis area VA clinic for their veterans actually handles things all the way from cradle to grave. Right here in Minneapolis. And I did not know this until about a year ago when I started taking on the support needs, the IT support needs of all these various customers. But the National Cemetery here in St. Paul on Fort Snelling is the fourth largest national cemetery in the nation.
So do you help, do you have like a kiosk that people can go to and maybe somebody's there or they can self-enter information?
Yeah, it's our kiosk grave locator. So it helps them find exactly the loved one that they're trying to find when they come to visit. And of course, recently we had Memorial Day, which is the busiest, you know, time of year for the national cemeteries and certainly for the Fort Snelling National Cemetery. And so, well, we have a couple of kiosks that are there all the time, year-round, for people to use, and the staff is extremely helpful and friendly and willing to help anybody. We supplemented that with an additional 6 computers over that Memorial Day weekend. I believe, and I'm not sure if it's the weekend or if it was actually on Memorial Day, but we had over 50,000 visitors to the cemetery Memorial Day weekend.
So could a person, without talking to a member of the staff at the cemetery, could a person walk right up to a weather enclosed kiosk and put down Lorraine Fortney?
Sure.
And that's all you'd need? Or
Well, I mean, there's a little bit of deciphering that has to happen because of the way that the graves are laid out. So if you're not familiar with how they're actually identified, which rows and which columns, then you might need to ask somebody. But the tools are there so that
you could figure it out. However, the staff is so incredible to work with and so friendly there. I'm not sure why you wouldn't want to talk to someone if you need some help.
I had, unfortunately, the honor to bring my buddy to his grave, and he was cremated. And when we got there, the escort, American Legion, VFW, maybe both, they basically, we were told that they will carry the, it's a real cute, not cute, but a very nice casket that the ashes are in. And the daughters insisted that I carry it. And they said, no, we carry it. And the daughter said, no, he carries it. And then they said, well, then, if he carries it, he has to walk in formation with us. And I said, yes, sir, I'll do that.
Right.
So I had people on both sides of me, and we walked in step. And I placed the little coffin on the thing there. But I thought, wow, I actually broke protocol there. And I, but they were insistent, but then nice about it.
Yeah, and there's a, I mean, tradition kind of dictates that. And it's something that all military-involved entities, whether it's the VFW, whether it's the Legion, whether it's active duty, whether it's reserves, whether it's National Guard members, honor guard is what we call that, the burial detail. We take that very seriously because the person that we're honoring with that ceremony has earned it. They're somebody who, you know, is 0.5% of the population that ever chooses, we're an all-volunteer military, chooses to serve the country in that way. And every single person who raises their right hand and puts on that uniform is willing to give up their life for every other person in this country and for what this country stands for. And so we don't take that lightly. The honor guard is extremely important to us, and we want to pay the ultimate respect for someone who was willing to make the ultimate sacrifice if called upon.
Does the cemetery provide the bugler taps?
So as you go through it, there's a lot of variations, but if the family doesn't have one, yes, we find.
Okay.
They sometimes it's the honor guard includes that. Sometimes it's somebody in the community. But we make sure that the family's needs and wishes to the best of our ability are met.
Yeah, that's really sad. You hear the taps and then the presentation of the flag. And it's just very emotional for a lot of people. And our community here, thank you to the VFW Club and the American Legion, have a wonderful memorial service every Memorial Day. And it's very heartwarming. And we have a nice park.
We do.
You know, with all the flags, et cetera.
Yeah.
It's 20 minutes after 10 o'clock on the Wayne Eddy Affair. My guest this morning is retired Lieutenant Colonel Brian Bornick. He is now working with the VFA as an IT guy. Did I say that right?
You are.
Is that for intelligent?
Yeah, I wish. Information technology.
Oh, information technology. We will be back in just a moment, and we're going to talk about Saddam Hussein's sons.
Where the city meets the farm. Great Rice County Fair.
We'll see you there. The Great Rice County Fair and Faribault will soon be here, July 17th through the 22nd. Get your hands on summer's best deal, Passport to Fun, your ticket to unlimited rides on Gold Star Amusements for the entire fair for $45. Advance sale at Faribault Hy-Vee, Fairway Foods in Faribault, and the Rice County Fair Office. Contact the fair office for prices effective July 17th.
Where the city meets the farm, the Great Rice County Fair. We'll see you there.
If you need to send a box far away or something overnight, what a cool sign for your business or a banner for your birthday. And you don't know how to do it, we'll help you through it at the Grab Big Mailbox. You can make copies, get supplies, find a box, ship a box, buy stamps, fax a letter, get your mail, send your mail, make a sign, design a sign, fix a sticker, print a poster, FedEx, DHL, UPS, Speedy, or even through the U.S. mail. If you don't know how to do it, we'll help you through it at the Grab Big Mailbox.
Well, 22 minutes after 10 o'clock on the Wayne Eddy Affair, a short edition. It is Friday, once again, July 13th in the year 2018. And retired Lieutenant Colonel Brian Bornick is with me. He's an IT guy now for the VAs. And we talked a little bit about what he did over in over in the war zones that we've had for almost your lifetime, it seems. And what you talked about the first IED, and let's see if I got it right. You're going along, and boom, not a Humvee, it's called
a Striker.
A Striker, and it has a protection from underneath in, mm-hmm. in a form of a V with metal and that. Okay, so boom, it goes off. Now you're trained to hold your, put your hands around some bars that are like roll bars, and you have a translator with you, and he doesn't know that thing, so you flip it and it goes two times, and everybody is okay because they did the bar movement, but the translator, he was bouncing around inside and injured maybe more than one.
So the guy,
rotator cuff.
Yeah, the guy sitting next to me had a broken forearm. As a result of the impact with the interpreter, and then they impacted me, and that's what kind of injured my shoulder.
And then, of course, you had three other people in the parade of vehicles that immediately went to your protection.
Mm-hmm.
There was a firefight, and then I learned that it isn't like you see in the movies, a firefight, you don't know where they are except maybe a tracer bullet or audible efforts,
mm-hmm.
and they got away. And I asked you, how frustrating is that?
Well, that can be pretty frustrating because obviously, you know, the majority of people that you work with and the time that you spend are good people who want a better life for them, their children, et cetera. And then you run into the, you know, what I'll globally term the bad guys. So the insurgents, the fundamentalist extremists that are kind of invaders to that country as well, whether it's Afghanistan or Iraq or anywhere else in the world. That's not the indicative of the indigenous population. They're foreigners who came to fight on their soil instead of, you know, their home turf. So it's frustrating, right? I mean, you got somebody who basically, because of an ideology, just wants you dead. And I don't necessarily wish the same thing for anybody, but the more times that those guys have an opportunity to try and make that happen, the more people who get hurt. So we try to stop that, hopefully through detaining, right, being able to capture them and incarcerate them like other criminals, but sometimes it's war.
No, when you have that interpreter next to you, and last time we talked about trust, you have to trust them.
You do.
But when they're talking to an individual within their own little camp area or whatever, mm-hmm. and you get a feeling like this guy is lying, I think he's hiding some insurgents wherever, and your interpreter doesn't tell you that, but you get, do you ever get that feeling like, I got to go further with this, even though I can't speak the language, got to let him know that I know that he knows.
Absolutely. Absolutely. And if you've been around the block a little bit, you have a, kind of a sixth sense. You tend to trust that. So somebody who I think was a good president, a good leader, his name was Ronald Reagan, he said some things that kind of stuck with me, not only as a military leader, but also as a person. And one of the things that Ronald Reagan kind of made famous was the term trust but verify. So you need to trust your people. It doesn't matter what. As the CIO at the VA, I've got 40-some people who work for me. And I need to trust them. I need to trust them, give them guidance, give them vision, and trust them to execute that. Same thing goes in the combat zone, whether it's your soldiers or whether it's an interpreter that you're working through. So you trust, but you don't ever blindly trust. You still need to verify. You need to follow up. I was blessed with the fact that as a higher-level leader, I didn't have just one interpreter, although that one interpreter that I kind of built that trust with tended to be the one that went outside the wire on missions with me and represented my conversation with the people that I was meeting with. But I also had, you know, 15 to 20 other interpreters. And so as we would go through, especially if we did broadcast messages, I would have other interpreters review that. There's lots of methods and ways that you can do the verification.
In other words, a guy gets on the radio to tell a village mm-hmm. that we're coming in and we have our guns at ready, so give up before there's a firefight. He might say, hey, they're coming in, get ready to go.
Yeah.
And so you have another interpreter that says, hey, he just said this, not that.
Yeah.
Oh, what a mind game, huh?
Well, it is, and that would be a very bad move for that interpreter because they're contracted employees of the U.S. government, so they're making a pretty good salary. Comparatively, they're taking a risk. So what you don't understand probably It's not talked about a lot, but I have an opportunity, so I'm going to take advantage of it. Those interpreters actually put themselves and their families at risk by working for the U.S. government. So even if they decided that they wanted to be a double agent, so to speak, not every insurgent out there is going to know that that interpreter is a double agent. And just like in wars past, World War One, World War Two, Korea, Vietnam, we mentioned in our last conversation that you don't really salute officers in a combat zone because it indicates who the person in charge is, and that makes them a pretty large target. Those interpreters carry a pretty big target on their back, too, because the more resistance that the indigenous population provides to the insurgency, the less likely it is to succeed. And so through fear, intimidation, and brutality, insurgents try to at least sway the indigenous population into indifference, if not active participation on the bad guy side. So they don't really do that very often. It's pretty evident when one decides to play the other side, and we take the appropriate action to make sure that that doesn't put our soldiers, our Marines, our airmen, or our sailors in harm's way.
Something just popped into my mind. Several years ago, there was a hit movie or a TV video that showed Americans and others on their knees, and then they cut off their heads on, and it was on YouTube or wherever you could find it. I've never seen it. I never wanted to see it, quite frankly. Were you in the service at that time when those horrendous things were happening?
Absolutely. Not only was I in the service, but I was in Iraq when, you know, there was a lot of people have a lot of feelings about that, but one of the things that I probably feared and carried with me every day that I was in a combat zone was the thought of, if I were ever captured, would the last thing that my kids, as they grew up, because once it's on the internet, it's there. It doesn't go away. It's always searchable, findable. Would they see that as my end? And that was one of the things that I really didn't want to happen. So, it's a reality. I mean, there's nothing pretty about combat. It doesn't matter what war we talk about in the history of the world. There's nothing pretty about it. And there's a lot of concerns and risks, and that's why you train so hard. That's why you develop that rapport and that trust and that belief in the person on your left and the person on your right. A lot of people here, I think, at home, on the home front, want to make it political. But I'll tell you, in the foxholes, in the asymmetric warfare that you're in, where you find yourselves, to the soldiers, to the military personnel, it's not political. It's no different than having a job and maybe not agreeing with the vision that your leaders at your place of employment work or develop. Your job is to execute on that mission, and in a corporate setting, it's to be profitable. In a military setting, it's to stabilize and bring peace and hopefully protection to those that you left back home, the loved ones that you have, so that armed conflict doesn't come to your backyard. Well, so it's about the people on your left and your right.
Well, I'm probably fantasizing here, but if you were aware of the fear that you had in regards to what if my children were able to see a YouTube or whatever video of my being assassinated by a sword, not a bullet,
mm-hmm.
Do you carry something with you that if you're captured, you see it in the movies all the time, that if you're captured, you can take a cyanide pill or whatever?
Well, we don't have that, but we carry with us a lot of bullets. So, you hate to say it. Combat tells you a lot about yourself. You find out a lot of things about yourself, what you're, able to do, what you're willing to do, what you're capable of doing. My whole thought in that was a driving force that kept me going in some of the, worst times I've ever experienced in my life. Is I wanted to come back home and see my kids, hold my kids, tell my kids I love them. I think that drives a lot of people. I don't think that's unique to me. I think I shared that with a lot of my brothers and sisters there.
No, we talked about the, I think you said something like six times you were involved in IEDs or firefights or whatever.
Mm-hmm.
And we talked about the first one, mm-hmm. and you just shouldered that and went on with the sore shoulder. Say mm-hmm. that fast. And you also mentioned a couple of guys that I remember somewhat vaguely, and that's Uday and Kuse, the sons of Saddam Hussein.
Mm-hmm.
What's the story behind that, or should we take a break so we don't have to interrupt you during the story?
Yeah, let's take a break, and we'll come back with that one.
Okay. I think I may have seen some video of the place that you're going to talk about, which was a palace someplace out in the desert.
Mm-hmm.
Residential or commercial, Cannon Valley Water in Dundas is the place to call for water. Whether it's a complete water conditioning system or just salt delivery and filters, Cannon Valley Water can take care of it. And Cannon Valley Water can also deliver Candy Yohai premium water right to your house or business at great rates, too. Chippewa Springs is as pure today as it was when we first tested it over a century ago, and is proudly distributed by Cannon Valley Water. Pickups are now located at 609 Stafford Lane in Dundas, just behind Aldi. Call Cannon Valley for your water today.
Millstream Commons Assisted Living is where the all-star seniors enjoy life in Northfield. From the delicious meals, the bright, spacious apartments, the volunteer projects, the bus trips we take, classes we attend, and the music we enjoy, there's something for everyone. At Millstream Commons, we treat everyone like an MVP. For more information, call 507-650-0141.
We're back live and in color from the studios of KYMN Radio in downtown Northfield. 50 years old, September 27th, 2018. That's coming up on 1080 AM. And, of course, now the 195.1 FM. The one. The one seated in the chair across from our studio here is Brian Bornick. Brian is a retired lieutenant colonel. He now is an IT guy for the Veterans Administration. And I'm going to ask him now. He's a veteran of the Iraqi and Afghanistan and Iraqi and Naki and Saki and Bosnia and whatever. But you've mentioned these two guys were the sons of Saddam Hussein, and I vaguely remember something about them. Who were they?
Yeah, so they were. Saddam Hussein was a dictator. These were his two sons. They were. Wannabe dictators, I think, raised in that, very very privileged, but very detestable individuals. They did not value other people's lives, and that became very evident to me. But there was a time when I was actually in Iraq. We were doing combat operations. Probably 3-4 different times we thought we had credible intelligence on their location. We were certainly very interested in finding them. Removing Saddam Hussein from power was one thing, but then removing that influence from him and his family over the Iraqi people so that they could establish their own form of government and their own future, that was part of our mission. And so after a few failed attempts, we did get some information. We pursued it. We found out that this was the most credible information we had to date. And ultimately, after about 3 days of chasing these leads and the two individuals, we were able to kind of identify them and locate them into a compound area in central Iraq, not too far from Tikrit, which was Saddam's hometown, where he was born and raised.
Before you go any further, what did you know about these two guys and some of the things that they did regards to supporting the?
So there was a they called it the Northern Palace of Saddam Hussein, but it was a place that was on the northern edge of Mosul, Iraq. The Tigris-Euphrates rivers come together up there. It's actually kind of a very lush, not desert-looking place, very opulent palace, gold faucets, large pools, just something that you would see today in, royalty or Hollywood or something like that. And I went in there. We actually conducted some interviews, people from the communities, imams, sheikhs, religious and political leaders in the communities. We would meet in this palace because it was fairly secure. We actually had possession of the land around it, so it was a relatively secure area in the community, and it was a safe place to meet. So I was having a meeting with a couple of leaders, and we got there probably an hour, hour and a half before the meeting was to start, and I went in with my interpreter, and we were walking through this first floor kind of rotunda area. And as I looked up on the second floor balcony, there was a balcony that completely encircled the entire second floor. And I thought, my experience at the time, I equated it to maybe walking into a capital, a state capitol building. That's kind of what it reminded me of. Big dome area, big rotunda, open area on the floor. And, you know, marble floors, like I said, inlaid gold, statues, very opulent. And my interpreter got about halfway across the main floor. And I saw him pause. I mean, he was just very, it was a very emotional, kind of a very reflective time. And since we had some time before the meeting was to begin, I kind of took the opportunity and I talked to him a little bit about it. And he explained to me that this palace, Saddam didn't go there very often, but his sons used it as the, kind of their primary place to operate out of. And on that second floor along that big rotunda, about every 12 feet or so was a door all the way around. So many, many doorways to rooms. And what I learned from the interpreter was this is the place where Saddam's sons would, or their henchmen, would actually abduct young ladies and keep them there, secure them there behind these locked doors. And when Saddam and Hussein would come back to the palace and they wanted to, you know, have a fun night, they would parade all of these young girls out to the balcony area, and then they would choose which ones they wanted to party with, and the rest of them would be escorted back into their locked rooms, and you know, Saddam's sons Uday and Qusay would do whatever they do, and more times than not, that was probably the last night that those young ladies lived on this planet.
So they use and then kill.
Yes.
Well, I can see why you wanted to chase those guys down.
Yeah, they were pretty bad guys.
Okay. So now you're chasing them down, and you get some information that's true and some information that is misleading. When did the true one come through?
Well, like I said, after, you know, three or four kind of failed attempts, either it was false information or it wasn't timely enough for us to actually capture them. We did locate him, and we set up a perimeter, and we tried to get them to surrender and come out, and they refused and obviously started fighting back. And so ultimately this was televised pretty much around the world when we actually did locate them, and it was accurate. We didn't really have much choice because they weren't going to give up, so we kind of leveled the building around them.
With
lots of things.
Mortars and...
Yeah, we had lots of, infantry carried weapon systems, as well as, of course, we had air superiority, so we had some smart bombs. We used what we needed to actually neutralize the threat.
Now, one of the things that I wonder about is even the movies from the Second World War is... antique, old, historical buildings did get destroyed, but sometimes they try to avoid that. Was this mm-hmm. a holy place, or was this just a rich guy's palace?
No, this was just a larger-than-normal house.
Okay, so in other words, it had no significance to the area. It was just a...
It didn't, and we were very cautious, right? I mean, there were safe havens because we didn't want to destroy culture. I mean, ultimately, the goal is to allow Iraq to actually develop their form of government and their future. And so we didn't want to destroy. And, of course, being the partners that we are with the Iraqi people, anything that we destroyed, American taxpayers usually helped rebuild. So we tried to be very, very good stewards of not destroying things, only to have to rebuild them later. So sometimes we knew bad guys were in mosques, and we didn't take action. I mean, we tried to surveil. We tried to watch them. We tried to find out where they went when they left the mosque. But we didn't level mosques. That's a holy place, and we wanted to respect that. Knowing as a psychological operations, one of the things that I bring to our maneuver commanders, our you know, battlefield owners on the ground, is an expertise in the culture. And so as a cultural advisor, That would not. It might achieve an objective in getting the bad guy, but it would probably ultimately do a lot more harm with our relationship with the Iraqi people, destroying, you know, their mosque. So there are certain things that we certainly took great pains to avoid damaging or creating more problems than it would solve.
So these guys are holed up in this palace, and so you call in the Air Corps, and you call in specialists, and you drop the building, knowing that they're inside.
Mm-hmm.
And there are television cameras on you. Is that intimidating that you have press actually videotaping your action? I mean,
so there's still laws to warfare. I mean, it's a brutal thing, but from my standpoint, what we're doing isn't pretty. War is an ugly business, but there's still moral and legal and ethical parameters around it, right? I mean, a bad guy wants to kill a lot of very innocent people, and unfortunately, there's casualties. What we try to do in that is limit collateral damage to those that aren't combatants. So these two were definitely combatants. I mean, by every definition of the term, they were shooting at us. They had no intention of surrendering. It was very likely that they were going to harm innocent people if it was allowed to continue. So when you're faced with that choice, I think ultimately, in the emotion of the time, somebody may always have a differing opinion of what could have or should have been done. But as long as you follow those ethical, those moral, and those legal parameters in armed conflict, then I wouldn't do anything different, knowing that the press or the world was watching, than what I did there, because those were my compass guiding principles.
So they died inside the building?
They did.
Okay. And then did the people then?
Our preference, by the way, Wayne, I want to let you know, we're a country of laws, and those laws mean something to us, and they not only founded this country, but they are what has allowed this country to continue to be great. And our preference was to actually capture them and have them stand trial for their crimes against humanity. It wasn't to kill them in the building. They just didn't give us any other choice.
Did the townspeople, go in and drag the bodies out and cheer?
There was some celebration, yes.
Okay, like the time they pulled the statue down?
Yeah, similar, very similar.
Where were you when you heard about Saddam Hussein coming up out of a hole?
I was actually training in preparation for my deployment over to Iraq. So that was I think there was a collective sigh of relief and success when we were able to locate Saddam Hussein and be able to bring him to trial. And I think there was a lot of closure for the Iraqi people as that progressed. And ultimately, Saddam was executed for his crimes against humanity. So I remember that. And I remember thinking that I made the analogy previously about being on a sports team, and you practice and you practice and you practice ultimately to get to that championship game. And I think that's a similar feeling when you find Saddam Hussein like that, and you're able to, be part of the justice equation, then that's kind of equivalent to winning the big game.
Yeah, you think that, it would have been nice if he would have just given up and put on his general uniform or whatever and parade out with the sword by his side and say, I give up and here, preach to my people. But that didn't happen. 14 minutes before 11 o'clock, another break, and we'll be back. I'd like to hear about IED number 2. Okay? Our guest this morning on the Wayne Eddy Affair, retired Lieutenant Colonel Brian Bornick, and he is currently the IT guy for the VA up in St. Paul, Minneapolis.
This is Twins first baseman Joe Mauer, the legendary legend of legends, baseball son of the Twin Cities. Minnesota lore foretold of his greatness, and it couldn't have been more correct. He stands among us today, part myth, part man, all Minnesotan, all-star, five-time Silver Slugger, three-time Gold Glover, MVP, and one hell of a nice guy. That is Joe Mauer. This is How We Baseball. Get your tickets to see Maurer and the Twins at twinsbaseball.com.
Where the city meets the farm, the Great Rice County Fair. We'll see you there.
The Great Rice County Fair and Fair Bowl will soon be here, July 17th through the 22nd. Get your hands on summer's best deal, Passport to Fun. Your ticket to unlimited rides on Gold Star Amusement for the entire fair for $45. Advance sale at Fair Bowl Hy-Vee, Fairway Foods in Fair Bowl, and the Rice County Fair Office. Contact the Fair Office for prices effective July 17th.
Where the city meets the farm, the Great Rice County Fair. We'll see you there.
Are you looking for a lovely home in the heart of Northfield? This Saturday, Jesse Seed with Edina Realty will be hosting an open house at 1190 Spruce Court from 1 to 3. Check out this 4-bedroom, 2-bath ranch-style home with over 2,700 square feet of living space, including oversized living room and staircase filled with natural light from the bay windows and skylights. Outside, you can relax by the pool on the custom wraparound deck. Come inside and unwind in the family room with wood-burning stove. All this and more for under $300,000. Come to 1190 Spruce Court this Saturday from 1 to 3 to see this amazing house and all it has to offer. Or check it out at jessesteed.com.
We're back on the Wayne Eddy Affair, KYMN out of Northfield, Minnesota, 12 before 11. And Brian Bornick is my guest here this morning. And Brian, we talked about the first IED that you encountered. And I believe that you mentioned that about six times you got were under attack by IEDs.
Mm-hmm.
What about number two?
Well, most of the other six were pretty anticlimactic. The 5 days in, the first one that we talked about, that was by far the most impactful and one of the most dangerous situations I found myself in right after arriving in country. Number two was, basically the engine block of the Humvee that I was in absorbed the majority of the blast. Everybody inside was, safe. Nobody. In fact, all six IEDs, I didn't lose any member of my unit in the vehicle with me or in support of the convoy that I was in. So I was very blessed, very lucky in those instances. There is one that I'll talk about. It's the only one that actually I was part of, but I wasn't in a vehicle and it wasn't my vehicle that was attacked. We were actually in a marketplace, outdoor marketplace. You can see them all over the world, similar to my time spent in Korea. They would have open marketplaces where people would come and get their daily, meal, food, everything, vegetables, meat, whatever, it's all there, and people would just come and shop. Well, this marketplace that I'm talking about was split into two sections, a north section and a south section, and we were on kind of right in the middle, maybe the south side of the north section of the marketplace. There were probably a couple thousand people there. On the very north portion of the marketplace was a Iraqi police station. And as the insurgency kind of gained ground, Iraqi police stations and Iraqi army training centers became targets for the insurgents. And so this particular day, the insurgents had made some homemade explosive using uric acid. They put, a couple hundred pounds of this uric acid explosive into a dump truck. And they used this vehicle to actually deliver this improvised explosive device into the north portion of the marketplace and the Iraqi police station. And it was a suicide bomber. He had his arms actually tethered to the wheel so that he couldn't change his mind, and drove it right through the marketplace into the front gate of the Iraqi police station and blew it up. Now, you can imagine a couple hundred pounds of explosives, whether it's homemade or whether it's military grade, can carry quite a punch, and that's exactly what it did. And I remember this is probably the one time that in the actuality of living and operating in a combat zone that it seemed kind of Hollywood movie like to me, because the explosion either killed or injured a number of people at the blast site, but it also, an explosion has unseen effects, shock waves, just the fact of shaking the ground, much like an earthquake, lots of things. So people fell down, people were knocked over. Depends on how close proximity you were to the blast radius. The unit that I was with, we were actually not that far away, and we did lose our balance. We did have debris flying by us. A couple of our soldiers were hit by either people or flying debris as this happened. We obviously recovered, regrouped, and as we're trained to do, began to move towards the explosion. so that we could investigate it, so that we could secure, so that we could safeguard people, so that we could do. And really it turned into, you know, more of a medical triage situation. There was no complex attack. There was no follow-on firefight. It was simply the dump truck exploding. And that was the entire intent of that attack. However, the aftermath and what that creates on the human body, I can't even explain. And it was, there's dust flying, there's the smoke from the explosion, there's all kinds of things. And, you know, that's, to me, that's kind of the horror part of war, is when you see those kinds of things happen, when you see a grandfather carrying the lifeless body of his grandson out of a fog and a mist. It seems kind of ethereal and not something that I would wish anyone to have to witness or see. But I will tell you that the soldiers that I was with, the Iraqi police, we did lose probably half a dozen Iraqi police officers in the explosion, the ones that were by the gate, manning the gate. They really didn't have much of a chance. And ultimately, I'll tell you, as we sorted through the rubble, after we got people safe, after we got them moved away from the area, we were able to secure the area. A lot of investigators come on, a lot of EOD and other bomb experts. We partnered quite a bit. I don't know if most people know, but the FBI had a large presence there, and they did a lot of the investigation of especially, you know, explosive-type scenarios. One of the things that we did locate were, you know, fragments of the vehicle, fragments of the bomber, so that we could help try and piece this all together and understand what happened. And I can tell you that I know that the arms were tethered to the steering wheel, because we found the steering wheel and about up to the elbows, you know, those arms were still a part of the steering wheel, although there was no, you know, identification of any other body parts. So
not a pleasant sight to see.
Not a great memory, and probably not one that I'm going to be free of for the rest of my life. But
well, you know, they say it's good to talk about it, you know. Have you been diagnosed with post-trauma PTSD?
Yes, I have.
Okay. What's that like? Let me say that. I very seldom have nightmares, okay? But the other night I had one, and it was a crazy one. It wasn't about war or anything, but I couldn't shake this person. And I was in a, I want to get out of there, and thank God I woke up.
Mm-hmm.
Is that kind of like it is that it brings back haunting memories?
Yeah, and there's different things that can trigger it. And everybody's a little different, but for me, I can tell you one of the strongest triggers that bring back unpleasant memories from my experiences happens to be scents or smells. There's very unique spices that the Middle East uses to cook foods. And although, as I mentioned before, I spent a lot of my time actually living and working with indigenous population outside the wire, dependent on them for food, for security, really for the fact that I'm sitting here talking to you today. So I got very familiar with eating the indigenous foods cooked by the indigenous people in Iraq. And I'm very thankful for it. I actually love much of their food. However, when I would go to, whether it's on vacation or army business or civilian work, to areas that would have a lot of Middle Eastern type food cooking, you get those senses without any thought, without any conscious effort on my part. Some of those things would come rushing back. You find yourself in areas. There were certainly times that I remember, and my wife, also a combat vet, two tours in Iraq, also very impacted by the dangers of war, several injuries and several surgeries for her side of that service as well. I think the fact that we both have PTSD, we both understand what it is like to live with PTSD, because that's something that's very hard to explain to somebody who doesn't understand or live with that. I think we're good for each other in the sense that we can understand when that happens and help people through it. And she's been, you know, kind of my guardian angel, my saving grace, if you will, as I've processed that and as I've you know, continued my recovery with PTSD in the sense that when I find myself thrust back into some of those situations, even though my surroundings aren't that, it feels like it is. And there are times where I've had to get up and walk out of restaurants, or I've had to walk out of crowded areas just to reduce the anxiety, to feel a sense of security, to get my bearings again. And, you know, it's, I can't tell you how grateful I am to have somebody who not only understands that, but helps that happen so that you can regroup a little bit as an individual.
Well, I understand what you say because it's so simple. The smell of homemade bread or an mm-hmm. apple pie or roast beef, you know, mm-hmm. those fortunately are pleasant memories, right. But it does trigger the Thanksgiving dinner at grandma's or whatever. So I can assume what you're saying. I mentioned Vietnam veterans, a helicopter is a scary thing to them,
mm-hmm.
and loud noises all of a sudden. So it's a problem for a lot of people that have been through yeah. what you've been through.
And I can tell you something that recently happened, but the first couple of years that I was, you know, post my deployments, the 4th of July celebrations were not what I remembered as a kid. They were very different to me after being in combat. The fireworks are an amazing thing, and it's a celebration of our nation's birthday, our nation's history. But they carry with it a lot of loud booms that tend to remind you of things differently after you've experienced it. So that was a big transition, and not something I expected.
How about TV shows or movies that have the rat-a-tat-tat of...
I can tell you both my wife and I have certainly movies that we maybe watched before we deployed are movies that we choose to watch now. I think anybody who served in the combat zone probably has their fill of, you know, the blood and guts kind yeah. of movies. And while, you know, initially that was extremely hard, and I've actually gotten up and walked out of movie theaters because I didn't anticipate that there would be scenes like that. I just wasn't prepared to handle it. Whereas now I think I could probably get through it, but most of the time I choose not to immerse myself in that.
The movie that a woman directed, The Sniper, it was about a sniper. Mm-hmm. You know?
American Sniper.
Yeah. You know what? It's available now on our
DVD,
cable.
Yep.
I just won't watch it. Mm-hmm. I don't want to watch it. And just like the movie that Mel Gibson directed about Jesus Christ,
mm-hmm.
I just didn't want to see that movie. I didn't want to see all that blood and guts. Yeah. So
they're very emotionally impactful, and I'll tell you, I didn't watch it when it first came out, but not so long ago, my wife and I watched a movie that has some scenes in it that were a little more difficult than others, but it's called The Hurt Locker.
Oh yeah,
it won a lot of awards. I'll tell you, and I think my wife would agree with this. I think maybe many military people would agree with this. The reason that I enjoyed kind of push through some of those uncomfortable scenes and watch that movie and at the end of it can say I think it's an enjoyable movie is because it talked not so much about the combat portions, but the mindset, the PTSD, the sense of serving something greater than yourself and the struggles that somebody who comes back from a combat zone has, knowing that their brothers and sisters are over there and you're back in the safety. I mean, I think in combat when you experience it, and certainly if you've lost people in combat, you come back with a sense of survivor's guilt.
Oh, yeah.
And so it's hard to be here when you know people who are over there in harm's way. And I think the Hurt Locker did an excellent job of actually capturing that, you know, mental fight, that mental battle that you go through after you come back.
What was that about, briefly?
Well, it was about actually an EOD specialist, a person who actually is called in when an IED is discovered to actually disarm the bomb and keep it from harming civilians as well as military yeah. personnel.
Well, and it's very dramatic.
It is.
He approaches it slowly and mm-hmm. gets on his knees, and I won't ruin it for anybody
no.
if you haven't seen it. But, yeah, I'll tell you. It's Saving Private Ryan, I think, mm-hmm. is a movie, and they show storming Normandy mm-hmm. In the Second World War. That was so real, mm-hmm. and I just, oh, man, how people like yourself can go through that and sit down and have a chit-chat, it's pretty amazing. I admire and respect you in the service of the United States Army, United States Air Force, the United States Navy, the United States Marine, the United States Coast Guard. Mm-hmm. I salute all of you. Thank you for maybe we'll get together again and talk about some other. I want to ask you, and you don't have to answer it now, but mm-hmm. maybe on another Friday, there is a probability that there may be an end to Afghanistan.
Mm-hmm.
And my feeling is all that work and then goes back to, you know, it's like Vietnam.
Mm.
And yet at the same time, well, it's about time. Yeah, kind of get your opinion on that some other Friday, all right?
It'd be my pleasure, Wayne.
Yeah, I'm sure you have an opinion.
I do.
Okay, thank you.
Thank you, Wayne.
Okay, we've been talking to retired Lieutenant Colonel Brian Bornick, who is now a boss at an IT guy at the VA. And someday, hopefully, we'll have his wife, Michelle, on the air. She, too, is a retired officer from the United States Army. This is your radio station, 1080 AM, Northfield, Minnesota.
95.1, the one. Still a friend you can count on.
You know, sometimes I don't know why, but this old town just seems so hopeless. I ain't really sure, but it seems I remember the good times with just a little bit more in focus.